Welcome and thanks for listening to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and if you're just joining us, we're listening to Wild Weather with Chris Field, David Freeberg, Karen O'Brien, and Michael Oppenheimer. And they're talking about the extreme weather of 2011.
We're discussing extreme weather events at Climate One. Our guests today are Chris Field from Stanford University, the Carnegie Institution for Science, Dave Freeberg, founder and CEO of the Climate Corporation, Karen O'Brien, a professor of sociology and human geography at the University of Oslo, and Michael Oppenheimer, professor of geosciences and international affairs at Princeton. I'm Greg Dalton. One of the themes that people talk a lot about these days are resilience, resilient communities. So Karen O'Brien, what does that mean? People able, you know, we're not going to be able to prevent these events. What is resilience?
Well, resilience is, it's about being able to handle change, being able to respond to change in a way that doesn't actually flip the system into a whole different state of being. So a lot of people think of resilience as just be going back to what it was before and things, but it also, it's about being adaptive, being flexible, being able to deal with these changes that are coming in a way that has both a short-term and a long-term perspective. So community resilience, for example, is about how people together work to respond to changes.
And minimize damages. I think there's, is it Bangladesh? That's one of the examples where there have been some fortifications against extreme weather events that have helped reduce deaths and help people sort of bounce back.
Yeah, I was there a few years ago, quite a few years ago now. And, you know, the people in the southern part of the country, they all live at sea level. Some of them have essentially temporary dwellings on sandbars. So these cyclones used to rip their way up the Bay of Bengal, slam in. And, you know, these were among the poorest people in the world. And there was one cyclone in 1970, may have killed a million people. We don't even know because nobody counts. So they went about, eventually, they went about installing an early warning system so people had knew the threat was coming. And they built concrete bunkers so people had a place to go. And the death rates in recent storms are much lower. They're lower by, again, up to a factor of 100. Now, still a lot of people die, but it's thousands instead of hundreds of thousands. That's a big difference. And those are relatively straightforward things to do. There are parts of this country where we could stand to do things like that, too, and we're not doing them.
Straightforward and low cost.
Relatively, yes, that's right. And, you know, the examples are legion. Some things are not done because people don't think of them. Some things aren't done because some governments at some level sometimes are incompetent or for some political reason. And so you had a situation like New Orleans where Hurricane Katrina was able to do incredible damage, partly, not entirely, but partly because the city just wasn't, you know, wasn't prepared beforehand. It wasn't prepared with a good evacuation plan. And then the federal government didn't seem to help very much for a long time in cleaning up afterwards. So at all levels, that was a disaster, not just, it wasn't a natural disaster. That was a disaster that people helped create. And we can do better than that.
Are we prepared to do better? If Katrina happened today, would the United States be better positioned based on your science and lessons we learned?
I don't know how to answer that. Do you, Karen?
No, I think that the learning process has been going on, so we understand why people were vulnerable to Hurricane Katrina, but whether we have actually taken into account, you know, there are lots of things are happening on the ground in terms of reconstruction of homes that are better, more, you know, raised and things, but it really remains to be seen when that emergency happens, whether we can respond. But it's a learning process, and it's iterative, and we know that that we have to expect the unexpected.
I suspect this is a case where we could probably learn some things looking to Bangladesh.
Interesting. London's another case that they've done some things. They sort of planned for the 300-year flood rather than the 100-year flood. Karen O'Brien, you want to talk about the Thames and what they've done there?
The Thames barrier is, you know, they've really kind of changed. They've gone beyond business as usual to actually take into account changing risk and, you know, different possibilities, and they've done the cost, the accounting, and, you know, they look at climate change over the next 100 years and probabilities of the 1 in 100 year flood might be coming down to 1 in 50 year flood, and the possibility that at some point you may have to just let the water in and what that means. So there's a lot of like kind of complex thinking going on, but it's an enormous social significance because so many people are living in that area.
California's been doing some work learning from the Dutch, who they plan for the 300-year flood, but they don't plan for the 1,000-year flood. They recognize that, well, at some point, there's going to be topping over those levees and have structures that are, well, the ground floor might get wet, and that's okay every once in a while because the cost of building for that 500- or 1,000-year flood is so exorbitant, especially in today's today's situation. We mentioned Thailand earlier, and I want to go to Toyota recently cut its, this is astounding to me, and there's some other examples. Toyota recently cut its profit forecast for this fiscal year 54% because of the floods in Thailand hit production. They had a shortfall of 230,000 vehicles worldwide because of the floods in Thailand. So anyone who read about the floods in Thailand and said, oh, that's poor Thai, it actually directly hit the bottom line of the world's largest automaker. What does that tell us about our interconnectedness and our vulnerability? Chris Field?
You know, in the climate world, we talk a lot about teleconnections, how a change in the sea surface temperature in the Pacific can influence corn yields in Africa. But I think what we're seeing now is that we're increasingly tied together by social teleconnections, where a flood in Thailand influences the production of hard drives, and that influences Toyota or Intel or people in the Bay Area. And what we have found when we've looked for vulnerable regions and vulnerable sectors is that there really are vulnerable people everywhere, and there are vulnerable sectors everywhere. Vulnerability is concentrated in pockets, and we want to be acutely aware of those. But we need to recognize that it's very difficult to predict at this point where the connections are going to be that are going to tie those floods in Bangkok to consequences in Japan or in California.
Amazing. Dave Friedberg, you have a little bit of expertise outside of agriculture. Let's talk about sort of the supply chain risk, the business risk, that is, you know, this Thailand or whatever else. I think we might elaborate a little bit on Chris Fields mentioned Intel. They also downgraded because of Thailand.
Yeah, Intel 2 days ago announced that their Q4 numbers were going to be significantly lower than expected because they sell a lot of semiconductors into hard drives, and the hard drive supply chain was disrupted by the Thai floods. So I think in an increasingly global economy where the supply chain extends across multiple geographies, and this goes for food as well as electronics and technology and auto and so on, it starts to heighten the effects that folks have been predicting and forecasting for some time on sort of an individual basis. So now you own Intel stock in your portfolio, you're going to start to wake up to the fact that, well, extreme weather is occurring, and it is something that can be impactful to me. What we hear a lot from farmers, for example, is that they don't really think about climate change by reading headlines about climate change forecasts. They think about climate change when they've had a significant loss 2-3 years in a row, and then they wake up to the scenario. And I think the psychology of risk and the psychology of loss is such that you don't necessarily put it in place and you don't necessarily think about it unless there's something you can relate to it, unless there's an experience you've had associated with it. And so as much as we can put out reports and there will be media coverage and so on those reports, it's unfortunately the fact of human nature that unless folks have seen or experienced significant loss, they're not necessarily going to start to relate to it. And I think we're starting to see that. As these extreme weather events impact global supply chains, it's going to start to hit you either in the supermarket or in your stock portfolio or in some other way. And so more folks are going to become aware of the impact of more volatile extreme weather and climate change as a result of these experiences that they're starting to have.
The Securities and Exchange Commission has rules about disclosing carbon risk in portfolios. Do you think that they ought to, or can you envision a day where regulators would say that companies need to disclose or measure extreme weather risk?
That proposal was put forward earlier this year, and I think it passed, but it's very hard to implement, and it's very hard to say what are the standards associated with it. So you have to disclose climate change risk.
But Intel probably didn't say, well, floods in Thailand, we're going to get hit, right? Who thought
of that? How do you know, right? I mean, how do you model the relationship between things that have never happened before and how they could impact you? And so that's really where this discovery process begins, is when a loss or some sort of experience that you can relate to or something else that affects you in some way starts to occur, then the discovery process begins. And then folks, whether it be governments, corporations, or individuals, start to really engage in the discussion about how climate change can affect me in the future. And that's really, I think, starting to happen.
Dave Friedberg is founder and CEO of the Climate Corporation. We're discussing extreme weather at Climate One. Anyone else want to jump in on that? Chris Field?
Well, the one thing I would say is that it's really important to remember that we're talking about things that have never occurred before, and how do people build an awareness of that? In the climate science community, we think increasingly about building resilient societies so that they can cope with challenges that they haven't faced. I mean, one of the things that's very frustrating is that even in the presence of scientific information about the way things are changing, people are slow to act because they don't act until they've had the personal experience. But there are a lot of smart, low-cost things that could be done to make societies more resilient. If there's a message from our report that needs to get embedded in the fabric of society, it's that those investments can really help, and they can help deal with the unknown.
Michael Oppenheimer?
I don't want to sit here too long without adding that there's another pillar on which addressing this problem stands. Our report was fundamentally about how humans can reduce their vulnerability and exposure to these types of events, but we should all remember that cutting the emissions of greenhouse gases is going to cut the part of the risk that relates to the way climate is changing. And that's we can't really solve this problem ultimately by doing just one or the other or supporting ourselves in just one pillar. We need both of them.
And recently there was a UN conference in Durban where countries agreed to have a legally binding agreement that will take effect in, 2020? Was that a significant step forward?
The significance of that event is kind of inside baseball, but it's worth understanding. In 1995, the countries agreed to negotiate an international accord on limiting the greenhouse gases, but they made an exception for the developing countries, and they said the responsibility would be on the U.S., Japan, the EU, et cetera. That's, you know, now 17 years ago almost. And in the meantime, the world has changed, and the biggest greenhouse gas emitter is China, and India is a big emitter, and some of the other countries like Brazil are growing in importance, and the relative importance of the U.S. and the EU, for instance, is shrinking in that particular regard. So I think in recognition of that, the countries finally managed to at least agree that there should be some sort of, I don't want to exactly say binding, but a legal obligation. I don't remember the exact wording, that involves all the countries, all the significant emitters. That was a major step forward, but it won't mean anything unless over the next 5 to 10 years the countries actually start to act to reduce emissions. Now, certain parts of the world are doing things. You're doing things here in California. The Chinese have developed a big renewable energy industry, which could help us solve the problem quicker. But unless there's really a cooperative action on emissions where countries stop fighting over this and every country does what's possible and they reach some sort of international agreement to collaborate, we're just not going to avoid what the community calls dangerous climate change.
Michael Oppenheimer is a professor of geosciences and international affairs at Princeton. Anyone else want to get in on Durban and the significance, whether that's going to reduce the risk? Chris Field?
Well, at Durban, I think the
Durban,
most
UN
important thing in from the UN Climate Conference is that the countries agree to keep talking. There are a lot of things that could be done at the local and the national scale. Michael says California has been a leader. Australia has a carbon tax now. But the fundamental thing that's going to be required in order to get the problem under control is having a price on carbon, and that if that price is determined locally or regionally, it's just not going to work as well as if we can eventually come up with a global price and a way to ensure participation by the major emitters that's consistent with their contribution to the overall problem, with their ability to pay. It's a hard problem, it's going to take a lot of work, and it's going to take a lot of political leadership to get from where we are now to something that really works.
Chris Field is the director of the Department of Global Ecology at the Carnegie Institution for Science at Stanford University. Dave Freeberg, you're into modeling the future. Do you see a carbon price in your models? Or is that outside of what you do?
Outside of what we do. I think that's a politically charged question. We purposefully try and avoid those. So we spend zero time identifying causality and trying to identify connections between drivers of volatility patterns. We look for patterns, we look for signals, we look for teleconnections, we look for analogs, we look for things that we can use to identify what the distribution of outcomes might be in terms of weather events over the coming couple of years. And we don't spend any time looking at sort of the long-term drivers as an organization.
Okay, but there's a lot of scenarios, a lot of corporations, and perhaps some of your, if you have large clients, do model scenarios in which there is a price on carbon or there isn't, because there is a price on carbon in Australia, a very low one in Europe now, so global enterprises have to kind of game this out and say, okay, where are we going to allocate capital? If there's a carbon price, it's low right now, so...
If one were to state that...
You're not getting off that easy on that one.
Yeah, that's fine. So if there's a relationship between carbon and climate patterns, and there's a relationship between changing climate and one's profits, you're either going to have to pay in the future or you're going to have to pay today. And so if you're an enterprise that is going to see some impact or there's going to be some global impact from changing climate patterns, or the world is going to be impacted by changing climate patterns and that's going to be caused by something you're doing, you're going to have to pay the cost. And that you're either going to have to pay the cost in terms of lost profitability in the future, or there could be some cost associated with buying carbon credits today to conduct your business as usual. Folks, as we saw with Intel, for example, the managers of public companies discount the economic impact that climate change can and will have on corporations. And especially in an increasingly global supply chain where volatile weather can occur in lots of places, which means if you have a supply chain that's touching lots of places, you're even more affected by volatile weather in a shorter period of time. They're going to see that cost. As we saw with Intel, the stock dropped 7%, lost billions of dollars in value. And so it starts to make sense to say, well, if there is a relationship between carbon and these sorts of effects, we should start paying up for it now, and we should start charging for it now, and hopefully reduce the effects in the future.
Because so far, all of the conversation has been about costs in the future, right, or consequences in the future. Oh, climate change, sea level rise will get us in 100 years, or someday climate change is really going to get us. But when it starts to affect this quarter's profits, that's a big change in terms of the temporal relationship between climate and when it's starting to hit the bottom line.
We don't know that the Thai floods were a consequence of climate change. I mean, it's important to recognize that
there's
what
no
we're
fingerprint
saying is
there.
That very well, you know, what we know is that heavy precipitation events are increasing. The dice are being loaded, and that we're not going to be able to attribute individual events.
But if you went into the Intel boardroom, would you say, hey, look, you know, this is happening, whether it's Thailand or whether it's another event, this is going to hit your bottom line.
If I were advising investors, I would say you should think about paying now or paying in the future. But if I were advising the world, I would say, look, only a small fraction of the impacts of climate are really felt in the market. There are additional impacts that are on natural ecosystems, on biological diversity, on the lives of poor people who don't have incomes that are measured in thousands of dollars per year. And when we think about the climate problem, we want to make sure that we think about the whole problem and not just the problem that's reflected in the bottom lines of the big corporations.
Right. But so we're, as a species, we tend to be more reactive to the direct consequences rather than the social consequences.
Individuals tend to be risk averse, but when we act cooperatively, there's a tendency sometimes to underestimate these very large risks because they do cost more money up front. And whether it's, you know, constructing the levees in New Orleans so they'd only take a Category 2 storm and didn't do it very well, and it wouldn't have done it very well anyway, or the Fukushima situation where you let the waste accumulate in an area which, you know, a tsunami could infiltrate. This is no surprise. This happens when either private or public organizations make decisions about big things that don't happen very often. Those risks are very often underestimated. And here we have a whole set of these risks coming down at us in the future. And we really have to think sensibly about it because we can't afford to make a mistake.
Karen O'Brien?
Yeah, I think it really brings up ethical questions and questions of values. You know, whose values count as we determine the future? And we know that we have a responsibility for some of the changes that we're seeing, and we have a responsibility towards future generations. So there's a lot of questions that have to really be surfaced when we're talking about how do we respond to these changes. So I can see that the businesses have an important interest in profits, but it is about people. It's about our future, and if we just start to look at costs and benefits and carbon prices and things like that, we forget the underlying essence of the issue, which is about sustainability
humanity.
And
there's huge debates among experts in academia about what value to place, the discount rate, they call it, what value to place on those future costs and future generations. We are going to bring a microphone up here and invite your participation. If you're on this side of the audience, we'd invite you please to go around to that door where Jane Ann is in the red to form a line, and then we have our on-deck seat right here. And welcome you to make a brief comment or a question so we can get everyone to participate. We welcome you to make one-part question. If you need some help, I'll be happy to help you with that. And I want to ask one other question while we get situated, and please, this is often the best part of it is the audience participation, so don't be shy. Step on up and do that. We're discussing extreme weather at Climate One at the Commonwealth Club. Our guests are Chris Field from the Carnegie Institution for Science, Dave Freeberg from the Climate Corporation, Karen O'Brien from the University of Oslo, and Michael Oppenheimer from Princeton. Let's talk about weather varied vulnerability. Are there any safe places where, if you live in Princeton or Palo Alto, are you more or less at risk? Does wealth insulate people from this kind of risk?
You mentioned Princeton, a very wealthy community, but they can't get their flood situation straight. Every time there's one of these intense rainstorms of the type that are increasing already, The roads are knocked out and the university shuts down. So, they, you know, it happens all the time. And New Jersey is one of the wealthiest states in the country. It's a confluence of several drainages. Several rivers come down there. And they don't want to either move the people out of the floodplains or spend the money to really defend the area. It's mostly northern to central New Jersey. So, you know, every community has some vulnerability.
Chrisfield, Palo Alto?
Major flood, 1998. A heavy rainstorm associated with a high tide event, and sea level will, of course, exacerbate that. And it just means that lots and lots of houses in the floodplain end up with their basement full of water. Flood is incredibly expensive to deal with. And what we've seen globally is there's been a big increase in economic losses due to disasters. And the majority of those economic losses are in the world's developed countries, the rich countries. Of course, the majority of the fatalities, which are also critically important, are in the world's developing countries.
You can hear great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Will Rogers at a campaign rally for FDR in 1932.
I don't want you to think that it's any wonderful honor to be asked to introduce this gentleman tonight. I'd even introduce Hoover if he'd come here. I'm a broad-minded man. I knew this gentleman. That's why I can be rather familiar with him. I knew him almost in childhood. I knew him when he first started in nominating Al Smith for things. We must have some 80 or 90,000 people here tonight. That's the most people that ever paid to see a politician.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.